Hello and welcome to Spotlight on Transitional Justice, the podcast series where we explore the relevance of transitional justice concepts for societies involved in ongoing conflicts with special emphasis on Ukraine. Today's episode focuses on the big question, and that is the relevance of transitional justice in a world of today which is facing profound challenges to international order. From the conflict to Ukraine, to the conflict in Israel and Palestine, to the conflict in Syria, Sudan, various other crises across the globe, the need for understanding and innovative and comprehensive approaches to the understanding of transitional justice has, I would say, never been more urgent. And it's only fitting that today's guest is Mark Freeman. I dare say one of the world's leading experts on transitional justice. Mark is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Integrated Transitions, an organization globally recognized for the innovation in peace building and mediation. Mark is also one of the founders of the International Center for Transitional Justice, the author of several seminal books in the field, including Negotiating Transitional Justice, Necessary Evils, Amnesties and the Search for Justice, and Truth Commissions and Procedural Fairness. He has worked for many years on the challenges justice-relevant contexts and peace negotiations in various countries around the world, and is a member of the International Panel of Experts of the International Commission on Missing Persons, among many other functions and engagements. Mark, thank you so much for being able to dedicate your time to this conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Refik, for the invitation. It's always wonderful to be in a conversation with you.
Mark, today's conversation will be about, let's say, social benefits of transitional justice in today's world. To do justice to that topic, we have to start with the current state of the world. In my introduction, I tried to allude to the rise of the large scale violence and profound challenges to the international order that's been built since the Second World War, where the transitional justice came as what we thought was the evolution of it in the right direction. And we, you and I, shared this journey, I would say, when we met some 20 years ago in the preparation for this recording. We discussed how the conversation was different and the world was different then. In light of what we are seeing today, how do you see the relevance of transitional justice? What can it offer truly today in this moment of global instability?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say this, Refik. I suppose at one level, it depends on which kind of transitional justice you're referring to. And by that, I mean, are you talking about the underlying ideas, putting aside the law, putting aside very technical concepts and mechanisms, and really thinking about the foundational goals, the foundational questions about how you face a legacy of mass abuse? I think if we're talking about transitional justice in that deeper sense, where we think of it in a societal sense, where we're looking at issues of that are very complex, in some cases very they're psychosocial issues, like narratives, an issue that you've worked on, or polarization. How do we overcome formative rifts in society that now have blood and crime added to them? If we think about transitional justice like that, I think there's a immense value and quite extraordinary stories. But if, unfortunately, if we're thinking about transitional justice through the prism of law, which and through the prism of a notional fight against impunity, if we've narrowed it in those ways, then I think it has less to offer today than ever before in my lifetime, because the trajectory, and you referred to it by mentioning some of the conflicts of today, I mean, I think the majesty of law, the respect for law, and a sort of Hollywood-like seduction of somehow magically international law could perform, it could impose itself on situations and turn bad situations into good situations. I feel that, and maybe it's a healthy thing in some ways, but I feel that version of transitional justice, which I would describe as a very legalistic or law-focused version, is at a very weak point. But I don't think that's necessarily bad. Maybe we're at a stage where the more societal approach and psychosocial approach to how, and victim-centered, of course, approach to transitional justice, we put aside a little bit our reliance on international law and think a bit more creatively. That early version of transitional justice, which is the one that I first was exposed to decades ago now, I think that is as relevant as ever.
This is a principle that I've been holding on to, and very often in different conversations, especially with colleagues from countries like Ukraine or Syria, for that matter, when people ask about transitional justice and its meaning and trying to get away from this idea that somehow it's soft justice, you know, all the misperceptions that we had to deal with over the years and decades of trying to clarify the benefits of these concepts. The one definition that I often go to is from the early days and the paper of José Zalaquet, where he doesn't even talk about transitional justice yet, and this is like late 80s, and talks about human rights policy of societies that are dealing with legacies of these mass atrocities, with two simple yet very powerful purposes. One is to repair victims as much as this is possible, as an obligation of all of us as a society. And the other is to work to make sure that this becomes impossible, that it is it doesn't happen again. And then within that, I mean, the universe of different approaches, some of which you alluded to, opens up. But let me ask you a question in relation to what you were talking about, the law. For a country like Ukraine that is facing an aggressor who is infinitely more powerful in various different ways, but also very importantly holds a seat at the UN Security Council with veto power, this international law becomes something that you hold on to desperately in trying to believe that there will be accountability, that there will be no impunity. And you can see that in Ukraine there is a huge emphasis on the prosecution of international crime when we talk about transitional justice. What is the realistic scenario when it comes to the hopes for criminal justice to take its course for crimes that were committed during the Russian invasion?
Well, I think it's imperative to pursue justice in that form, criminal accountability. domestically, regionally, internationally. I mean, I think it's just something that one feels is it must be done. This is, it's not for the law that you do it, though. It's not for the law that you do it. And I think the main point I would maybe reflect on in relation to your question is what it means to pursue criminal justice while the conflict is going on versus what it means to do so when that war, if it's a war or if it's a dictatorship, has come to some kind of formal close with lots of legacy issues that need to be faced. But those are very fundamentally different situations. And I would say that my observation would be that to a large degree, when the conflict is raging, when you are experiencing a river of blood, there's a natural urgency that this has to take. You can't imagine not pursuing it for such horrendous crimes because they're happening on an ongoing basis. You're not looking backwards. But what can happen is that that pursuit of criminal justice becomes hard to separate from the moment that very often comes while that conflict is going on where a negotiation is mounted. And then what do you do with that threat, that if it's become a credible threat, and that's, you know, you're trying to get justice, and the more successful you are, that of course can serve as leverage to bring about a negotiation. It can be one of the sources of pressure. The challenge from my experience directly, and I've written about this a lot as well, is this goes to what you mentioned about the article by José Zalaquette, which is what I haven't read that in a long time, but he talks about, if I remember correctly, an ethic of responsibility, if that's the article you're talking about. And the question I think that gets very difficult, which is morally agonizing, is if you effectively created, the threat of justice has become real and credible, and maybe you've succeeded in some cases with arrests and prosecutions and convictions, even as the conflict is going, but now you're in a negotiation. How, you know, which again, what is a negotiation? It is a method of conflict resolution in which necessarily there are mutual concessions. If you don't understand that, then you should not be negotiating. So, and of course, this is an existential threat, not only to those who have the most blood on their hands, but it's an existential threat to the possibility of ending a war in many cases. And that's the really hard issue that I've worked on a lot. So I think, as I say, in principle, it must be pursued. But I think the more that the actors who may find themselves in a negotiation can be prepared for the options, and there are options. There are good and bad ways to handle that in a negotiation. That's been the focus of much of my career. I think that's where knowledge becomes critical. You still need principles to guide you, but there are some do's and don'ts about how to manage that issue in the real situation with the really hard choices that too often arise. And so that's the situation that's very present in my mind when I think about criminal justice, because I've worked so often in the places where you feel that there's a trade-off that's going to be necessary. And then how do you manage that while still being, you know, principled?
What would you say from your experience, which is vast and highly relevant in terms of your role in various negotiations around the world, what are the examples that come to you in terms of the relevance of transitional justice concepts in an ongoing conflict that Ukrainians may look to for something to learn from?
So, before I give a specific example or two, let me maybe just say a bit more about the principles that I think one has to balance in these situations. And you've already referred to one of them, which is a balance between prevention, the principle of never again, stopping the war as a value and a principle unto itself, and then the imperative of accountability. I mean, it's a so I just give that as an example, but I think the you have to have some of these principles very clear in your mind. But in a negotiation, and this is another critical point, I would say analytically at the beginning, is that peace talks are not justice talks. Justice is an issue within peace talks. Right? So the priority in peace talks, which is why they are called peace talks, is peace. The biggest risk, I think, is that justice is overlooked entirely. So your listeners will, of course, be quite familiar with the Minsk protocols that were signed in 2014, 2015, thereabouts, in which there's no reference of any kind to any principle that you might recognize of international law or transitional justice or criminal justice, but it says there will be an amnesty. Right? So, and that's not such an atypical situation. Even today, even in the era of the International Criminal Court, the era of human rights generally, the biggest risk is that there's nothing at all. So In my view, thinking about some of the cases that I've worked on, probably the best known one, and I think it's an isolated case, but it might be relevant for Ukraine to think about, is Colombia, only because it was the one where I, in my own direct experience, the one where the most active thought was given by the protagonist in the negotiation, and I advised directly the government delegation. This was not mediated. This was a direct negotiation. There was extremely proactive thought, highly strategic consideration, principal consideration about how to do this. And there's a whole long set of agreements. It took a year and a half just to negotiate that issue, which was far too long. Most, you know, the conflict. But in that particular case, and this is, again, a critical factor, a critical variable, is leverage. Because if you care about these issues, then the best time to negotiate is when you have a lot of leverage, as the Colombian government did at that time, in military terms and in other terms. And so it could push those points further. But if the leverage isn't present, which is, in a sense, largely just a function of the balance of power in the battlefield that is mirrored in the negotiation room, that is a critical variable. So the timing for when you might manage these questions is critical. And here I can indeed give a contrast between the leverage that was available or not in those two cases, the Minsk talks and the Havana talks in Colombia. So these are some of the variables that have to be present in the minds. But if you don't even have in your DNA or in your talking points or in your toolbox ideas and know-how about the handling of, from a principal perspective, to make sure that you can strategically introduce, creatively introduce these issues into an agenda where they could easily be overlooked completely, where no one's there to say, then it's more likely than not that it won't come up really at all. It's considered a kind of dynamite. It's an existential threat and perceived to be so. So it's much easier to just leave it alone. So if you want it there, these are some of the variables that you have to be thinking about and planning for.
Tell me, what would you say if you were to make a case for transitional justice in Ukraine, in conversations with many of my colleagues from Ukraine, I've been trying to frame it in view of what kind of a society is going to emerge from this bloody conflict, which is affecting Ukraine in such profound ways. And this is where I think they begin to see the relevance of other concepts that are so close to transitional justice successes, if we can point to any, such as truth commissions and memorialization and reparations and different elements of kind of dealing with the legacies of massive violence. How would you make this case to them?
Well, that, you know, the first point, of course, which you and I both know and believe profoundly, is that the best chance of transitional justice, by far, of a quality transitional justice, one that will have the kind of societal and other forms of impact that at its best transitional justice can have, that is far more likely to happen if it is Ukrainian conceived and Ukrainian led. It's just a basic point, but I don't think we can ever start talking about transitional justice for a place without just, you know, reiterating that obvious, nevertheless obvious point. I mean, I suppose that we have to first look at what we want to do with the word transitional here in Ukraine, because of the fact that there isn't a transition, at least in the classic post-conflict transition sense. That is not the moment. It is a moment of war and survival and pain and trauma, and it's ongoing. The atrocities continue. So so there's thinking, you know, what do we do with the idea of transitional justice if we're going to take seriously the word transitional? So my thought would be the following. I mean, I would say that I think of this, you know, is when I think about mid-conflict situations, I think there's a sort of double speed or sort of dual approach that can be applied. The first part is asking, what can we do now that has utility now that helps us, a bit like you say, it's you know, I think there are the urgent things that can be done that over time, in the event of a transition, you've done some things. There is a set of results, and those are mostly, overwhelmingly, I believe, going to be things for victims rather than against perpetrators, meaning you can build up evidence. You can conduct investigations, you can do a lot of things, but you may not be able to use them in any effective way for a very long time. But I don't think that should, I think the risk would be to say that there's not more that can be done. And here I'm not just talking about, I mean, I did say what could be done for victims, but I also think what can be done in terms of reconciliation. And this may be very localized. It may be that not on a national level, but at very localized levels, there could be very important things that could be done now. Communities that need to heal now, maybe the war isn't actually happening in that area, but it's passed through there. What can be done in that community now? Communities need transitions. It's not only countries in that sense. So I think there's the what can we do now that has that brings results now. And it can be of take multiple forms. It can be accountability related. It can be reconciliation related, truth seeking. So, but again, from my sense would be that in the case of Ukraine, much of what can be done now would be at a more localized level in terms of that things that could bring results now. And then the second level, the second track, is the preparatory one. Thinking ahead, and that includes, you know, that kind of evidence gathering work that can be very important for later. One doesn't know whether and how it might be relevant later. Archiving work, things like that. It's very grim work. Taking testimonies, all those sorts of things, knowing that you can't use them and may never be able to use them, but you hope and you're working towards their potential future utility. And other forms of advanced thinking and advanced planning, without ever knowing, with any clarity, with any guarantees, when that moment may arise. But I think those two tracks, those two speeds are important. That would be my sense. And also to distinguish, to not keep things at the national and supranational level, but to try and find places where you could actually create the important stories, early stories, even while the war is going on, because there are places where it's maybe already, as I said, it's already passed, but there's a massive amount of trauma and healing work and other forms of work that are important, where at a local level, you also need a transition.
I would say it kind of emerges as the obvious track, if you want, what you just said, the focus on victims and using all the lessons that we have learned from various different contexts on the importance of investing early on in addressing harm done to victims, acknowledging first of all what they have suffered and making sure that the responses are adequate, that shame is removed, that like Jose Zalaket was saying, we do as much as we can as a community, as a society, to repair what may be irreparable. But tell me what you would say in this context is the importance of the concept of truth. And in this regard, I think maybe we can perhaps in a kind of idealistic way look to the past and talk somewhat about what successes we are aware of in terms of the work of different truth commissions and how they have contributed to this new society that emerged, or at least in part contributed to building a society that is able to put some distance between itself and the atrocities that were committed. What comes to mind in this regard to you, and what are also the challenges? Especially, let me just, I know that it is a long question, but let me just add an element to it. And that is that it seems, especially in Ukraine, that there is an ongoing battle, even as we speak, which is the battle for the narrative. And there is so much disinformation and so much dehumanization that makes, I think, the concept of truth telling and truth commissions as a tool even more relevant.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, truth and narratives. My organization, and you've been part of that, you've helped us think about this issue, I think, more critically. That is a very important, they're different, but either mutually helpful or mutually destructive dynamics, truth dynamics and narrative dynamics. So let me start with the truth part and let me cite you, Refik. Not even speaking about truth commissions, but actually about the truth function of courts. And you've written and spoken eloquently about how in your own country, your own home country, and also in the former Yugoslavia generally, you said something along the lines of, you know, the tribunals that have conducted work, and in particular we're talking, I think, about the international ones, they've established an ocean of facts, an ocean of truth. But the narratives about your in-group and the out-groups, the us and the them, I mean, it's almost like falling on deaf ears to some extent. So how to be have a let's say a narrative sensitive approach to truth, I believe, is important. A polarization sensitive approach to truth, the idea that you can sprinkle truth into a place and it will have this magical effect and it will open minds and people will be open to hearing things when their identity, their sense of self, their entire worldview requires them to reject anything that they hear that would disrupt that narrative. You have to really ask yourself seriously, what is the point of all the work on truth if you don't do a certain amount of very robust prior work and simultaneous work on narratives? Because there is, it's, you know, and this is an old debate that you'll also know very well from transitional justice. It's not a distinction that I made, but it's often cited, which is the difference between knowledge and acknowledgement. You know, and this comes up a lot in the literature and truth commissions and all this. And so, you know, truth commissions, I think, are going to work better where there's been enough disruption of maybe very entrenched narratives that the place, there's almost an unexpected level of openness to persuasion, to hear disruptive facts. You're going to have a better chance. But again, the truth does not perform magic. It cannot penetrate hardened narratives. It doesn't even touch them. It bounces off of them, like a stone bouncing off of the water when you throw it. So we have to do, those of us who believe that truth, establishing the truth, disseminating the truth, if by truth we mean facts, you know, I think that the narrative part is absolutely fundamental. And I guess the last point I would make, sorry for the long answer, but, you know, to this day, probably if you said to, you know, in the world, if you shouted into the world the term truth commission or truth and reconciliation in 2024, and anybody has any thought about it, it's almost certain that they're going to still refer back to South Africa, I would guess. Even today. And here, I would say that what worked in South Africa, which hasn't been replicated often enough, was a device by which, and again, you know it well, but perhaps some of your Ukrainian listeners are less familiar with it, but a legal incentive, which was amnesty, to encourage, just to be clear, also combined with the credible threat of prosecution, but the carrot of amnesty with the stick of a credible threat of prosecution led to a very significant number of perpetrators of very extreme human rights violations to come forward and on television and face their victims. And that's a different kind of truth from the one that comes from victims or from investigators, when it comes from perpetrators themselves, that is more disruptive in general, in terms of its ability to penetrate those hard narratives, to make people, because there's only a certain, we have a very high capacity, I think, as humans, we have a very high capacity of cognitive dissonance. We can go a long time, we can maybe go a lifetime with total cognitive, not total, but very high level of cognitive dissonance. But there is, I think, a tipping point that can be reached as a society, even, not even just as an individual, where it just becomes impossible. And here the last quote I would give, which again, you know very well, still refer to it, even though, again, it was written in the 90s, but Michael Ignatieff famously, referring to truth commissions, said that, you know, their most important function is to narrow the range of permissible lies. But again, if you have hard narratives that are identity-based narratives, profound, you come back to your scenario, you can produce an ocean of facts, an ocean of truth, and it will just bounce right off.
This is, I think, where we get back to the understanding of what is it that we are doing this for. That is the fundamental question that, in a way, shapes the chances of success of any of these mechanisms, especially when it comes to truth commissions. And allow me just a very quick comparison that may not be comprehensive in its analysis. But when we talk about South Africa, the truth commission was part of the effort to build a new narrative, to build a new societal narrative. And if you think about it, its power in allowing people to actually absorb the truth that was generated in those hearings that came from victims, that came from perpetrators, was that the doors were opened in a profoundly fundamental and decisive way by other elements that perhaps did not have directly anything to do with transitional justice, and that is with the messaging from Nelson Mandela, him, for instance, wearing the Springbok jersey in the Rugby World Cup and kind of leading the way even against very serious objections and threats from his closest colleagues and comrades in the fight, because people very often forget that Mandela was not simply a man of peace. He fought for a long time as a fighter for what he believed in. That this opened the possibility of these truths being absorbed in the service of this mechanism, helping the country transition from the brink of civil war after the apartheid ended to somewhere where it could actually look at all these things. While, for instance, just off the top of my head, for instance, Tunisian Truth and Dignity Commission, which was, I was there, I was witness of it, I worked on it. It was profound in terms of delivery of these truths to the nation, because the technologies had moved on. So it was not only television, but social networks, and people could hear these long suppressed truths. But it did ultimately bounce off of this wall of other narratives that were basically created by powerful people, some from the old regime, some from the like new political forces, which were completely disinterested and unwilling to actually allow for any of these truths to form the new power dynamic. So I would say this planning of what is it that you do it for and how you go about it is crucial. What should Ukrainians be concentrating on right now when it comes to transitional justice in this respect?
Yeah, well, great question, Refik. So I think you're right that if you're going to think about transitional justice, think about it in the very profound way that you're proposing, which is to say, you know, what is it for? Have absolute clarity about it, the why of it all. And I'll say something that may be hard to hear, but I do think it's something that is not in any individual's control, perhaps, but is something that can be important for what transitional justice looks like. Because I think that with an ongoing war, how that war is fought, how that the principles according to which the values and the standards you hold yourselves to as institutions, as a society, as, you know, as neighbors, transitional justice in a sense is also for now in that regard. I mean, the more you descend, the more you descend during a war, the more difficult it will be to come out of. I think somehow the how of fighting a war. I'm not saying that there's an easy way to afford to fight a war like this. There's no easy way to afford a war like this. I just think finding that can be an important ingredient for later. Why I'm saying that in part is it's not just what the head of government decides or the head of the army decides. It's also what individual ordinary citizens decide about their role. Are you going to be a perpetrator, a bystander, an accomplice, an informant? All those things that are happening are actually part of the transitional justice to come. And the more that a society is anchored in a set of values, those narratives about not just why of what we're going to do later, but how we're going to fight this war. What are the principles? What are the red lines we will not cross? Is absolutely fundamental, I believe, to that why that comes later. Having that to refer back to is an important part of the rebuilding process. And here, one of the biggest blind spots, which I've written about and spoken about, but never successfully, convinced any truth commission or any transitional justice process to adopt. The closest I know was actually a truth commission draft mandate in your home country, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which has to do with this idea out of the post-Holocaust period, which was about the righteous among the nations. Transitional justice, we're always putting the spotlight on perpetrators and victims, a little bit on witnesses, maybe on accomplices, maybe on collaborators, but the righteous among the nations, the righteous within your nation, the people who represented, who took extraordinary risks to life, to liberty, to their families, to do the right thing under impossible circumstances. Those stories, transitional justice has very rarely captured in any intentional way. Mandates don't include it. It's not the job of courts to do that. Truth commissions, if it's not in their mandate, they're not looking for it in the same way. But those stories are fundamental because when you do need, you're not just rebuilding infrastructure, as we know. You know, you're not rebuilding roads. And even you're not even just rebuilding institutions. You're coming back to that question of the why that you included at the start of your question. And I don't think you're going to answer that why well, and I don't think you're going to build that new narrative, you referred to Mandela, you know, he used this term Rainbow Nation. That gave a North Star. It gave something. It changed the way you thought about what it means to be South African. But, you know, in Ukraine, I wish with all my heart that this war will end as soon as possible. But when it does, the stories of all those people who under impossible circumstances acted righteously, did the right thing, represent the best of Ukraine in all senses. Those stories are absolutely critical. They cannot be overlooked. And they give in themselves, those stories create that they answer that why question. Because in that sense, it tells you who you are and those always exist. There's no war in which there are not people constantly crossing divides, taking immense risks, doing the right thing. And if we don't get those stories, all you get is a national depression.
This conversation could go on for far longer than this podcast would allow. So I will choose two questions from a whole set that I still have in order for us to finish in a reasonable time. And the first of those has to do with the concept of prevention and the role that transitional justice mechanisms such as institutional reforms and reparations were envisaged to contribute to this second element of José Zalaquette's thinking in terms of trying to do everything to make these massive human rights violations impossible. Now, in this situation where you have an outside actor like we discussed, an extremely powerful actor, what role, if any, do you see for reparations as something that Ukraine needs to think about within the context of whatever transitional justice solutions they opt for?
I think it makes sense as a demand. I think it makes sense if there existed a lawful, internationally effective and lawful way to seize assets that could be part of a reparations fund without creating a very dangerous precedent for the stability of the international rule of law. If there's a way to do that, then I think it's a critical issue to look at. But I'm cautious, I'm answering a bit cautiously, because sometimes the justice of the cause is used. Not that I'm not referring to anyone in particular, but the temptation would exist for anybody that I have a righteous cause and I have a just cause. And so I can bend the rules a little bit because of the purity and the urgency of my cause. And that's a temptation that can exist in a circumstance like this. So that's why I'm answering a bit cautiously, just to say that I think all options should be explored, and I think reparations, what is important to say about reparations as well, is that it is a demand that can legitimately exist almost in perpetuity. I mean, in the United States, reparations for slavery, we're now in 2024. This is many, 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 many generations ago that in the United States slavery existed. This is a debate that I think is healthy and important to continue to have. It's just this week, just a few days ago, the Commonwealth had its summit, and this was an issue. I think these are profound questions, and I believe that they're generational and transgenerational questions. But in the short term, I would just say it's important to be careful not to cut corners if we're talking about reparations that would come from one country to another, which was the way that you had talked about it. And in the broader understanding of reparations, which includes things like rehabilitation, is part of the modern notion of reparation. There's a set of, you know, restitution of liberty and rights as part of a broad concept of reparation. In that sense, of course, there's a lot. But if we're talking about the way that most people understand this, which is financial, it's compensation, then that would be my reflection.
And the last question goes back to the beginning of this conversation. Like I mentioned, you and I met when Transitional Justice offered a lot of hope. It offered a promise of a set of different tools that we discussed in this conversation in the context of Ukraine being further developed, being refined, being tested and retested in order to contribute to this new commitment to end impunity, to ensure accountability, to make sure there is a more humane response to mass suffering, but also to prevent such mass atrocities from happening. Unfortunately, we are here where we are in 2024. Where will we go from here, Mark, in your knowledge and your now increased focus on peace mediation? Are we back to the age before these notions became relevant? Or are we facing a terrifying new future? Or is there something to be hopeful about when it comes to these concepts?
Yeah, well, again, hard question, but important question. I think there's a lot of scope if we can go back to the broader framing that is at the origins of the idea of transitional justice, whereby the law has its role, but it is in a minor role compared to this, I think, more societal and more political, ultimately, way of approaching this, more strategic way of approaching this. I think there's a lot of scope. So I'll raise maybe a few points just as a potential agenda, some of which may or may not be relevant for the Ukraine. I hope some of it is. One has to do with amnesty. In a certain way, there's been a kind of agenda of transitional justice, which, as I said, has been legalistic and punitive in nature. And that coincided, perhaps not accidentally, with the rise of international tribunals, ultimately, you know, culminating with the permanent International Criminal Court. And as part of that, I think amnesty and even the South African truth and reconciliation process, which relied on amnesty and was celebrated around the world, helped prevent a war in the view of many South Africans. That agenda of this legalistic punitive notion, which reduced transitional justice to essentially just being a fight against impunity and not much more, seemed to lead a lot of actors, multilaterals, NGOs, even academics, to have to destroy amnesty, destroy it. And I think part of what we need going forward is we need to find a way to recover a form of amnesty that fits with transitional justice ideals, because it does, and it's been there. It's a millennial tool for a reason. We have to take off some of the tips. So I think that's one thing. We have to think about amnesty in a more strategic way and in a principled way, but understanding it better and bringing it into the box of transitional justice. It's not something that should be destroyed. I think that's been a very big problem. And again, I've written about it and spoken about it a lot. But I think, especially because of the challenges of this moment, I think that's one part. A second, which we've discussed here, is again this critical point around narratives. In an age of polarization, an age of anger, an age of grievance, where we're listening to each other less and less with social media and so forth. I mean, this is another very big area of work of my organization is on polarization. We have with the Ford Foundation a global initiative on polarization, and it's made me much more aware than I was before of how polarization, what I described as a hyper problem. And what do I mean by that? It's not a problem, it's a hyper problem. Meaning, if this is a kind of problem that if you don't solve this, your ability to solve all other problems is more remote. And polarization is that kind of problem. It's a hyper problem. And that's an example. I'm just giving that as one example. But I think if we're going to do transitional justice better, if we're going to make it resonant and impactful and deliver results, especially for victims, but also more broadly, bringing more stability and peace for societies that are heavily traumatized. We have to take polarization more seriously. We have to address it. It can't be something on the side that we hope transitional justice efforts, truth and accountability and all these things will magically resolve. They will not. There needs to be interventions up front. And as I say, like a narrative sensitive and polarization sensitive approach to transitional justice. We have to be smarter. We have to be more strategic and less legalistic. Believe less in the law is really what I would say at the end of the day. Pursue it. I'm hardly meaning to suggest that we abandon the law. The very opposite. But the level of reliance on the law is massively counterproductive, massively unrealistic, and it is obscuring the incredible things that could be done to help victims and to help societies heal from insane levels of trauma. And so those would be a couple of points that I would offer by way of conclusion. At least we can't call it a conclusion, but a couple of final reflections until we speak again.
And I very much look forward to doing that, Mark, because I think the feeling that I leave this conversation with is that we kind of scratched the surface on so many different things that require further conversation, and I hope it will come soon. And I'm certain that this will be extremely useful to our Ukrainian colleagues and friends, because I dread the scenarios which I have to say I'm witnessing in many situations, where again this international spaceship of transitional justice actors lands with cookie cutter approach and talks about concepts in the same way as if we are in 1990 or 20, 30 years ago, without acknowledging exactly how things have changed and also how these concepts have evolved since then. To end this conversation, I will thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I look forward to seeing you at some point very soon and continuing this conversation.
Thank you so much, Refik. It was such a pleasure.